Which city are your jeans named after?
What's flappy about a flapper?
And was nylon really named on a transatlantic flight?
Don your etymological doublet and fire up your crinoline as we strut through textiles, fashion, and fads. This episode of Words Unraveled is tailor-made just for you.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of the etymology books Once Upon a Word and Words from Hell. And today we are unraveling the language of fabrics and fashion, aren't we?
Yes, we are doing some actual unraveling, or indeed raveling.
Oh, yes, indeed.
I don't think we've ever actually observed the fact that...
That those are contronyms?
The title is a contronym.
Right.
Yeah, there you go. But we're going to unravel some fabrics, some clothing, and some fashion.
Yeah, I mean, we are not figures known for our fashion. That's not entirely true.
Speak for yourself. I'm ever à la mode. This is all I wear. Merchandise. And what do you call it? Shackets, is it they call them? Where do we start with all this, Jess?
I feel like we should start with the fundamentals. The things we wrap around our fundaments, as the case may be.
You're taking us straight into underwear, are you, Jess?
I mean, okay, if we're going to start with garments, we should start with the basics and then build outward from there. It's only logical.
What's the first item of clothing you put on in the morning? Is that a personal question? I don't think it's a personal question.
I don't think so. I think that's... I actually have like a thing about this. I think that the worst thing you can do is put on your socks first.
Yeah. There's nothing more tragic than a man in nothing but a pair of socks.
Yeah, you go for the basic undies, and then and we have different words for these things, by the way.
Undies. Do you call them undies?
So I don't like the word panties. That's another word aversion that I'm not into. So yeah. A lot of people would call them that, but apparently that was a British term first. So. What I've got. And knickers was an American term first, so that's a fun one.
A knickers, is that an offshoot of Knickerbocker?
It sure is, which are named after Washington Irving's character, Diedrich Knickerbocker, who wore, in illustrations, these Dutch-style pants that were bloomish around the knee, and they were compared to women's bloomers in their shape, and then bloomers became called knickers, and then as they got smaller, the name stuck.
And Knickerbocker is a sort of deliberately preposterous sounding, Dutch sounding name.
We've talked before about how New York had a large population of Dutch folks, and that Irving in particular was kind of the voice of bringing these caricatures to life in his satirical and fictional works.
But we are getting at one of the big transatlantic rifts here, which is the meaning of the word pants, essentially, aren't we? Undies is a reference to underpants, and the British English pants is a shortening of underpants.
Much like knickers are and knickerbockers are named after a fictional character, pants are all named after a fictional character too. They're named after Pantalone from Italian Commedia dell'arte.
He was a strangely sexually virile yet elderly miser in Italian theatre, and still is, wore bright red skin-tight leggings that were supposed to represent his virility despite his age.
They were also like unfashionable for the time, so they were distinct.
When they became all the rage in Europe, they were, they were named after the Italian fella. And in French, they're still called pantalon, your trousers. Pantaloons has kind of died out, hasn't it, among us?
I mean, I think people will say it humorously, but that was sort of the precursor to trousers. We went from hose to pantaloons to trousers.
So the interesting thing here is that the American use of the word pants is a shortening of pantaloons, whereas the British use of pants is a shortening of underpants, which is in turn under pantaloons. I think we got to the bottom of that one.
Other undergarments from history that I think are worth mentioning that have also like changed meaning are the petticoat, which was originally a small coat that you would wear under your armor, but then shifted to be like an underskirt, another sort of thing you would wear under your fashion armor, you might say.
Right. And when we're talking about coats here, we're not talking about jackets, are we, as such? Mm-hmm. A bit closer to what we'd call a waistcoat. In Britain, we call a waistcoat. What do you call a waistcoat in the States?
It would be a vest, probably.
A vest, that's it.
A couple other options from history were pantalettes and drawers. pantalettes just being a precursor to panties. But drawers were so called because you draw them on first, which I guess kind of you draw anything on, so seems a little vague.
You've also got smalls and briefs, all of which are slightly euphemistic, but I think we've also gone into the other euphemisms for your underwear before. I mean, you mentioned fundamentals, but unmentionables and variants on that term have been used not only to describe your private parts, but also the cloth that cups them.
Yes, indeed. As well. Speaking of which, I mentioned bloomers, which they were like you would wear a shorter skirt and then sort of like voluminous pants underneath them. They are not named because they are in sort of a blooming shape. They were named after Amelia Bloomer, who was a women's suffragist and rights activist who advocated for this new outfit very strongly. And everybody thought they looked stupid. So they were heavily mocked in the culture of the time. They only lasted from like 1851 to 1855 because just like no one liked them.
There's something slightly incongruous about a, you say suffragette or suffragist, and ending up being known just for underwear.
For pants, right? I posted on Blue Sky the other day some illustrations from 1855, political cartoons of like women in pantaloons, like doing masculine things, like smoking in bars and proposing to men and being bad at being police officers. So they were definitely like sexisted out of existence.
Right, yeah.
But they also spelled the way for skirts to become shorter and, you know, more form-fitting legwear in the coming decades. Should we move to the outer part of the leg?
Yeah, let's keep our legs on.
When I was a child, I did not understand, and until later, I thought that breeches and breeches were two different things, but they are the same thing.
The word breech, in that sense, is related to the word to breach, to break something. Isn't it? And indeed the word break.
For the forked legs of the pants is my understanding, but it could also be because they were originally cut off at the knee, right?
Yeah, precisely. And then trousers is an interesting one. It's a Celtic word, actually, a word we get from Scotland. It's originally trews, and there's a sort of cultural reference that comes up occasionally in Britain. Donald wears me trousers. I'm not going to go into it, but it always has to be said with a very strong Scottish accent. And actually the word trousers is a bit of a mess because it is a plural of a word that is kind of already a plural. And also the spelling, because this could be spelled just T-R-E-W-S. I think the Irish word was T-R-U-I-S, but the T-R-E-W-S for trews was influenced by the French word trousse, which people will know from their French lessons as meaning your pencil case. But it could also mean something else, you know, like a type of trouser, actually, what we'd call it, a trouser, but not trousers. And the spelling of trousse, which is T-R-O-U-S-S-E, ends up influencing how we spell the word trousers.
Help connect the dots for me. Why is that already plural?
So this is the problem with all trousers, right? And all these sort of breeches and such, is they're a pair of a single. And that's where the confusion comes in about whether something is already a plural,
right,
or not. So trues are already a pair. Mm-hmm. And then
then
we make them trues as...
That makes sense. Someone mentioned in a previous episode, there was a comment that was like, I called something a trouser because in fashion contexts, like if you are shopping for a pair of ladies' trousers, it'll sometimes be called like the pleated trouser. And like they will call like a single unit of that a trouser, or the style can be called a trouser style. It can also be singular, but also it sounds odd out of that context. And I don't think that the person who commented that would have been shopping for a trouser in that way.
No, it is a thing with legwear, isn't it? We have a pair of jeans as well. We have a pair of pants. Yeah, we have a pair of shorts as well. Shorts, an interesting one, if I can briefly take a sidestep to that, because short is etymologically matched with shirt and skirt. They all come from old Germanic words that mean short. Skirt is from Old Norse. The ska sound usually comes from Old Norse. So the Vikings brought it over. And that sits alongside shirt, which comes from Old English. A lot of the ska words from Old Norse have a sh, spelled S-C originally. which I think is kind of interesting. Jeans, of course, has an interesting origin as well.
Tell me. I didn't bring this one. I know denim, but I don't know jeans.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's kind of a similar thing going on here. Jeans are named after the Italian city of Genoa.
Ah, just like denim.
Yeah. We'll get into that in a sec, but an old name in England for Genoa. It's weird that we call it Genoa, even though in Italian it is Genova, isn't it, I think. But we used to call it something even more different. We used to call it Jean, spelled G-E-A-N-E. And yeah, products from there became known as jeans. And ages ago, I think of jeans as quite a modern sort of thing.
Yeah, no, denim is old.
Yeah. But no, from the 1500s, people are talking about these jeans, which I thought was absolutely, absolutely fascinating.
The first ones that we might call jeans today were sailor trousers, right? Because they would make them like larger in the leg so they could be kicked off if you went overboard.
That's interesting. The first reference...
Is that right? I hope I'm saying
well, you know, I think it makes sense because the first reference I could find, this is in the OED, it's from 1577, and it is an inventory. So, you know, it was basically as a listing. Usually this will be a listing of something that's arrived on a boat or something like that. And it says 2 yards of white jeans. That makes me think of sailors.
Before we move on from the notion that like pants are plural, it's funny that the only type of leg wear that isn't plural is the one that actually was in two pieces. And that's like traditional hose, which was like you'd pull an individual leg up, but hose, you know, or are you going to say hoses? Whereas like it's Germanic. So hosen, you know, would be plural, but hose generally speaking in, well, you'd still say a pair of pantyhose over here too for like tight tights.
Yeah. And in Germany, you would say Lederhosen. You wouldn't say Lederhose. So you're using the plural there as well. And that hose is the same as the hose that you water your plants with, etymologically speaking. It means a tube.
Tube, leg tube.
And a fireman's hose. So a fireman is both wearing and using a hose.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we should, I mean, we touched on it, but tell us about denim.
It is from the French city. It means denim.
Yeah, it was originally a type of serge, and it was called serge denim. And my wife is from very near to Nîmes, so we sometimes land. They have a very, very cute little airport in Nîmes. It's lovely. You get off the plane and you're surrounded by lavender. It's usually in the summer, it's scorching hot. But the last time I was passing through there, the security guard, as we were, you know, we were making our way through, just getting all of our stuff out, taking our belts off and such, as you had to do, it took great pride in telling everyone that their jeans were named after his hometown.
He was so excited. I love that.
Yeah, he was absolutely thrilled. Yeah.
We should have had him as a guest.
It's true. And the word denim does appear in Webster's dictionary, his American dictionary in 1864, because it's in America that the name of it changes to mean the fabric that it now means. So that the name stays the same, but the fabric changes. And he describes it as a coarse cotton drilling used for overalls, etc. So not a serge.
Very much workwear before high fashion, right?
And there's another workwear material that's got an interesting place name origin that I'll mention here. I don't know if you use this word so much in the US. I think you generally just call them overalls, but we have this word dungarees in England. Do you use that in the States?
Not frequently, but someone will probably know what you're talking about.
So it is the typical sort of mechanics overalls, you know, it's trousers with a sort of flap up the front and a strap over the top. And
just call those overalls.
Yeah, you would. But in England, they get called dungarees. And there's a reason why they're called that in England. It's because it's a relic of the British Empire. Because in India, close to Bombay, modern day Mumbai, there was a hill fort called Dongari, which is where the Brits used to trade for certain fabrics. And there was this really rugged cotton that they could get hold of there that was, to start with, really great for making sails for ships and for tents. So they brought it back to England by the yard. And then they later, as we sort of industrialized, realized it was pretty good for work clothes as well. And so that word dongri turned into dungarees.
A lot of our fabrics are named after the locations they came from because fabric has been extensively an international trade item throughout history. So like muslin is from the Italian name of the city of Mosul, which is in Iraq, what is now Iraq. Damask is from the name of Damascus in Syria. Kashmir is from the Himalayan region of Kashmir. And then...
Yeah, let's not try and say which country that's in at the moment. It's a bit difficult, isn't it? I was going to say, speaking of India,
Right. A lot of these. Tulle is named after a town in central France where it was first manufactured. Tartan is, interestingly, a silk from Tyr in Lebanon, which is... It's been on all kinds of like crusade adventures. And then Argyle is named after the clan in Argyll, Scotland.
There's another interesting Scottish material, which is tweed.
Oh, yes.
Which, the story behind that's quite a funny one because it shouldn't be called tweed. It should be called tweel. The deal here is that tweed is essentially a type of twill, right? But in the Scottish dialect, it was called tweel. The English struggled with that for some reason and probably conflated it with the name of the river that's sort of on the border between England and Scotland and recorded the name of the fabric as tweed instead of tweel.
That's so interesting. I had no idea.
And we're stuck with it now.
Right. A couple others from different places. Gauze is named after Gaza.
No way, really?
Probably. It was originally a word for a type of silk, and then it was applied to ballerinas' tutus and then into other contexts and a number of other things that's in like Europe and English speaking countries, but it is probably Arabic in origin and may have been named after Gaza. So let me put a big maybe on that one because it's not certain. But same with silk is fabric from the Serics or Ceres, which was a name given to people in parts of northern China who traded silks to the Greeks. And then satin is named after a place in China known in Arabic as Zaytun.
Velvet is from the Latin villus, which means shaggy hair. Actually, it's the same origin as velour as well, ultimately.
Wow, no kidding.
We started off talking about clothing. We've already gone on to fabrics.
We went into the materials.
But we'll get back to clothing in a bit. But can I talk about a material that I thought was named after a place? And a lot of people think is named after two places, in fact, but it turns out it's not. That is nylon.
That sounds very like post-industrial to me.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's invented in the 1930s. The story that is often told, and the one that I was once told, and until this week believed, because I had no reason not to, was that nylon is actually a sort of, it's not an acronym, but it is a representation of New York, London, NY, Lon.
Fabulous.
The tale that was told was that the chemists trying to come up with a name settled on one during a transatlantic flight. Not true. It's just not true. It's just not what happened. There is, it is pretty well documented how nylon got its name, but the story is a good one.
It is a good one.
So it was invented and named by the DuPont company, a chemicals company based in Delaware, I think. And they were calling it Fiber 66 while they were developing it, but then thought, we need a better name for it than that. And they garnered hundreds of suggestions from staff and from scientists about what they should call their new synthetic fiber. They wanted a generic name for it. They weren't particularly looking for a mark or a copyright name for it. They just wanted what are we going to call this thing? And one of the suggestions was by the guy who did eventually put forward the name that was taken up, was to call it Duparooh, Duparooh.
That doesn't sound sexy at all.
No, it's like duped and poo and I don't know, like some sort of pooey kangaroo, a Duparooh. What that actually is an acronym of DuPont pulls a rabbit out of a hat.
That's amazing.
Quite sweet. Anyway, they don't call it Duparooh. We know that. They call it nylon. So what happens? Well, there is a good source for this. In Women's Wear Daily from 1940, they quote a letter from one of the employees of DuPont. It says, "We wish to emphasize the following additional points. First, that the letters NYLON have absolutely no significance etymologically or otherwise, because the names of two textile fibers in common use, namely cotton and rayon, end with the letters on. It was felt that a word ending in on might be desirable."
So we did the scientific ending convention exactly. where we pluck them off another word that sort of means that and then make it consistent-ish. DuPont also had these other like space-age fibers, the Orlon, Dacron, Antron.
Well, they said, they continued that a number of words were rejected because it was found that they were not sufficiently distinct from words found in the dictionary or in lists of classified trademarks. After much deliberation, the term nylon was finally adopted. Now, these other words, these other possible words, we also have another source to tell us what their thinking was around those and how they ended up with nylon. So the first thought by the guy who came up with it, a man called Gladding, was to call it no run. So not have that on at the end of it. Oh. The idea being that...
Because you don't want to run in your nylons, right?
No, it was supposed to be that the stockings, nylon stockings didn't run.
Yeah.
They didn't ladder. But turned out they did.
Wait, you call it laddering? That makes more sense. I like that better.
I like ladders.
Yeah. I've put my finger through so many pairs of what they would call nylons.
Oh, there you go. So this scientific and corporate strategy publication from 1988 tells the story that Gladding then turned it around from no run to neuron, but thought that sounded like a nerve tonic.
Yeah.
Which, yes, it does. It sounds like neuron. So he changed the R to an L, making it Nulon. This apparently was very similar to an existing mark, and Gladding realized that many advertisements would refer to new Nulon, a redundant sounding phrase, it is true. Next, he changed the U to an I and got Nylon, spelled N-I-L-O-N, which unfortunately, they say, had three pronunciations, nylon, nylon, and nylon, as we now pronounce it. So the latter one was chosen, and 5 of 66 was called nylon, spelt N-Y-L-O-N. There you go. There's the story of nylon.
Wow. Well, that's involved and convoluted as is product development as a whole.
So not named after New York or London. It was very nearly named after Delaware because one of the suggestions was to call it Delaware, W-E-A-R. But no, ended up with nylon.
Any other textiles or materials that you think have an interesting?
I like suede. That's always a good one to bring up. Originally, mm-hmm. gant de Suède, which is the French for Swedish glove or glove of Sweden, because they were made of this distinctive fabric that was particularly good at keeping the cold out and was worn in the Swedish style. And by the time it ends up in England, we're just calling them suede gloves. And then the name of the fabric becomes suede as well. So when you're wearing suede, you're wearing Sweden.
There are a couple of words that we use like daily now that are from textiles, but we don't observe that they are anymore. Like the word subtle means finely woven, originally referring to fabrics and also to other things that were precise or exact, but primarily fabrics. And interestingly, it's etymologically similar to the word underpinning, something that is subtle underpins something else. We use these terms now, but it literally like a weaving underneath is the sense there.
That's funny. I mean, I've never thought of the sub at the start of subtle because you don't say it as meaning what sub means in every other context, but of course it does.
We talk about, I think we may have addressed this one before, but to be bombastic is to be puffed up and to be dramatic. And bombast was cotton padding.
I remember you telling me about that. I love that.
From the Greek bombyx, meaning silk or a silkworm. Same with the word rocket. It's from weaving, I suppose. But anytime you are referencing a space rocket, you are also evoking a bobbin in the weaving process.
Right.
Because that's the same shape. Same with shuttle, also used in weaving.
Yeah, of course. The shuttle was a very important invention. I remember learning that in my history lessons at school. Spandex, by the way. Do you know why it's called spandex?
Because it expands.
Yeah, it's an anagram of expand. Yeah. I learned this.
I'm really glad I was right about that one.
Yeah. I just looked this up on Wikipedia, by the way. I didn't do any great research. It's just before just while I was waiting for you to log on. I was like, just look at spandex, where that comes from. Wikipedia claims that it's not really called that in Europe, which I did not realize. To be fair, I would call, if I saw someone wearing spandex, I would describe it as Lycra, which is more common. But another name for it.
Is that a brand name?
Yeah, I don't know, actually. It perhaps is. I think the generic term for it is elastane.
Well, that sounds horrible.
It does. And the only good anagram of it I could find was Eel Satan.
What?
Eel Satan. We can have tea lanes as well.
I did double check. It looks like Lycra and Spandex are both proprietary names.
There we go.
Spandex has been genericized, but Lycra is still registered by DuPont.
No way, really?
So, yeah.
I love it when we come round full circle like that. Right? That's marvelous that. Stuff. They've got a monopoly on the artificial fibers, I suppose.
Again, it's those like space age fibers. Like they were big into like defining modern American fashion in the mid-1900s.
We've ended up mainly with them in sportswear.
Yeah.
Should we get back to garments? We've done our pants. We've done the bottom half of our bodies pretty well.
We did the bottom half, so we should do some of the top. A couple of outerwear items. The frock, of course. We've got like a frock coat was originally like a menswear item.
Men originally wore frocks.
Yes. So first of all, it's from the old French folk, meaning a simple coat or a monk's habit. And then I think because it was also a monk's habit, it was extended to dresses too and coats.
Right. Mm-hmm. That makes more sense when you think about the word defrocked.
Yes.
It doesn't actually refer to taking your frock off you.
Another one would be the doublet. It's called a doublet. It is doubled because it has a lined padded construction, and doublets were tight hip length jackets that were buttoned or laced at the front, and particularly popular in, they extend back to the Middle Ages, but in the Tudor era, they had these flared skirts and were worn over hose.
Oh, I see.
While we are on this topic of Tudor wear, though, this is kind of from all over the place, the trunk hose, you see the like puffy pants?
Oh, yeah. Those were the fashion before the pantaloon came along.
You would wear those to like, I don't know, show off how much fabric you could afford.
That's right.
Let's see, what other upper body wear items can we talk about?
Well, we could talk about the cardigan.
Yeah, let's do that.
It's interesting in that it's named after a person, it's named after the 7th Earl of Cardigan, who led the famous charge of the Light Brigade of 1854 in Crimea during the Crimean War. It would seem that his guys were pioneering the wearing of this style of, warm clothing in very cold conditions in Ukraine. Incidentally, the word balaclava also comes from Ukraine around the same time, but that's for warming your head and your face. But Cardigan himself is named after Ceredigion, which is a place in Wales. So we could have included that when we were talking about things that are named after places. So that's one garment named after a British military man. Another one is the Wellington boot, which is named after Arthur Wellesley, the Duke of Wellington.
And you call wellies like the rain boots, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they're sort of clunky, rubbery ones. I mean, I'm guessing they weren't made of rubber when Duke Wellington was wearing them. No, probably not in the 18th, 19th century.
Other things that you can wear on your upper body would include, we're jumping around in time like crazy here, so we might have to come back so that we're time traveling.
It's frantic. It's frantic.
Yeah, right? The ruff is what I was thinking of, that like starched pleated collar you sometimes see Elizabethan men wearing, named because it has ruffles. Essentially, like that's the extent of it. But also, like the ruff of an animal's fur is sometimes a word for like the fur around its neck.
Right. Okay. So we've talked again. This suffix of the ul comes up.
That's that like frequentative suffix.
It's got lots of ruffs, so it's ruffly.
That's how bustle works too. It's a thing that like extensively busts out your behind.
Wonderful. And then while we're talking about neckwear, can we talk about the cravat, which is, I think I might have told this story already, but it bears repeating. It comes from the French cravat, which is to this day that just their word for a necktie, but in turn comes from their word for a Croatian, because it was a kind of neckwear that was worn ceremonially by Croatian servicemen.
Another word that used to be a word for a necktie or neck adornment? Tawdry.
Tawdry. Now, I've got a vague memory of you mentioning tawdry before.
Entirely possible that we have.
Is it not some sort of like, it's some weird mashing together of words or what's going on with the word tawdry?
Tawdry lace is St. Audrey's lace, which was used for neckties and ribbons sold around the celebration of St. Audrey. It became a tawdry, became a word for a silk necktie for women. And it came to represent like rustic or cheap finery because it was probably worn by like country girls and was like bought by tourists at such festivals and things like that.
Oh, that's a shame. So actually embedded in the word tawdry is a real sort of snobbery.
Oh yeah, for sure. And there's a lot of that going on here.
Indeed there is.
Since I mentioned bustles, it's worth noting the word farthingale. Imagine women in the Elizabethan era wearing the widest possible structured skirt you can imagine, where it looks like you're wearing a whole table, that yeah. you were wearing a farthingale, which has the goofiest etymology because it is a total misunderstanding of the French verdugale.
Ah, we're in folk etymology territory, uh-huh, are we?
Exactly. Mm. Farthingale has nothing, none of those words, farthing and gale, have nothing to do with this. It's originally from the Spanish verdugo, which meant rod, stick, or sapling. And comes from words for green, essentially. Sticks, basically, under your skirt. Another one like that would be the crinoline. It's from the French crin and lin, horsehair and linen, which is what they were made of. And they were also extremely deadly because they were very flammable and estimated, like reports from the era in which they were worn, which is around the 1840s, say that an estimated 3,000 women burned alive while wearing these flammable crinoline skirts.
There can't be a deadlier garment than that.
Surely not, unless it was intended to be.
I potentially deadly inspired garment is the bikini. If we can get onto the bikini.
Oh yeah, no, that's horrible, isn't it? Why do we? I understand why we call it, but I feel like we shouldn't.
Well, okay, so yes, it's named after the Bikini Atoll, the Marshall Islands, where the Americans tested out the A bomb. Was it? It was the A bomb?
Yeah.
What's your understanding of why the garment is named after that?
You know, I'm not sure. I would assume it's basically just that it was because it was known to American media and soldiers and sailors that the word became associated with like pretty islands.
Oh gosh. So people were aware couldn't think of any
other. I don't know the extent to which they were.
No, it's perfectly reasonable, Jess. The fact is, when no one seems to be particularly sure why the bikini is named after the Bikini Atoll, there's the rather grim idea that it looks like your clothes have been blasted off you. But I think the theory that people generally prefer is that the effect that a bikini would have on a gentleman's libido was somewhat explosive.
Ah! Okay, I've heard that. That's funny. That's funny.
I'm not sure I buy it, but I like it. So we've talked about garments and materials. We haven't really got into fashion yet, as promised. I have one note here about fashion, and it says, I don't know S-H-I-T about fashion. So Jess, help me out.
I mean, I am not well acquainted with fashion that extensively, but I do think that like the way fashion subcultures have been named, it's reflective of some entertaining trends in humanity. And your reference to bombshells reminded me of flappers, which has kind of
been dark. It makes me think of this, my flappy fan.
The original flaps, if we're talking about like a word applied to a young woman or a young girl, would be braids, essentially, especially the braids or ponytails that a younger girl might wear in the late 1800s that would distinguish her from women who were more likely to wear full updos.
A girl's flaps are her ponytail.
Not so much today, but...
Yes, they are.
but originally that was the idea. And we have a couple of, like, there are a couple of references of people referring to braids as flaps. Unfortunately, like, one of the reasons it was extended to sort of flapper fashion is because young female prostitutes were sometimes colloquially called flappers for having that kind of hairstyle, which is a little horrible to think about. And like when it transitioned into the fashion term, it was also about hair. Starting in 1895, a slim-figured adult who was a dancer or an athlete was more likely to wear girlish-style braids and ponytails, and a flapper-length skirt would be a skirt that's short, like one that a younger girl would wear. And then it was politicized as working women, including the sort of women who worked in, you know, as a dancer or an athlete, spoke up about voting rights. Like Punch magazine in the 1920s, even as late as that, identified a flapper as a woman in her 20s who wants to vote.
Okay. So it's to undermine them, basically.
Yeah, no way. I mean, it was also perfectly reclaimed by the women you would see wearing like bobbed hairstyles and like shorter, straight length dresses that are straight structured dresses that are a little shorter around the knee. Eugenics textbooks would say that they're like the worst kind of people, but also accurately described them as wearing makeup, having bobbed hair, and wearing low-necked, short-sleeved dresses.
I see. So those are the flappers. Can you tell us about any more fashion movements?
Well, so on the other side of things, and actually much older, is the dandy, right?
Right. Yeah, so why are they called dandies?
Two theories. One is it's short for the term jack-a-dandy, which really doesn't help us. But the other one could be dandy was a diminutive nickname, like a child's nickname for Andrew. So it might once again be sort of a like, oh, you little man. Interestingly enough, in the 1800s, women who dressed in a style that corresponded to male dandies was called a dandisette.
Oh, it sounds like a flower, isn't it?
You're right.
Like some sort of hybrid.
The dandy style began in the Regency era, particularly with figure Beau Brummel, who touted this like perfectly tailored frock coat, a white cravat, polished boots, and a well-brushed cane. His credo was, don't talk about your clothes, let your clothes do the talking.
Right. Famously well-dressed figure.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, this is cool because this will air shortly after the Met Gala had like black dandyism as its theme, which is very cool. Slave owners in the 1700s would sometimes like opulently dress up the people that they owned to show off their own wealth, which ultimately was reclaimed in like the later dandy movement.
It's interesting. Of course, dandy became an insult of sorts as well. I mean, not surrounding the slave movement, but you know, earlier in England.
In the same way as like macaroni and dude, for example, which are connected. Have we talked about this one before?
No, but that's something we absolutely do need to do in another episode.
Yeah, absolutely. But macaroni style was a similarly like effeminate, opulent, not even similarly. It's even older than what we've been talking about. We're like 1770s-ish England, and you would wear these towering wigs and like tight, bright colors and things like that. Macaroni style, named after the fact that at the time, macaroni was a fancy dish that you might get from the continent. So your young men would go to the continent and learn all about fashion and bring back macaroni to eat.
Why would one stick a feather in one's cap and call it macaroni?
Because Yankee Doodle was a dandy, right?
There we go. We got our dandies and our macaronis. Mm-hmm. All
and Yankee Doodle is the source of the word dude.
Oh, wow.
Which was originally a foppish, fastidious man, not a, you know, guy who, just your average guy. The original dudes were like the city types compared to country folks. Like a dude ranch was somewhere you'd go on vacation if you were from the city and wanted to experience the old West.
That's superb. Pulled three terms out the same little ditty there. I love that.
A couple other fashion movements from history with fun names. The Incroyables and the Merveilleuses, which were fashionable aristocratic men and women. Incroyables were men and Merveilleuses were women.
Marvelouses and the Incredibles.
Exactly. And this was like, so this was after, we've got like our earliest stage of fashion, like the high fashion all comes down from Louis XIV, of course. He was, you know, he made it into an industry in France, which is why France is still the height of fashion, right? Mm. But after the terror, after revolutionary France, there was sort of a counter movement where young aristocrats would still dress up very fancy. The Incroyables and the Merveilleuses had a couple of distinct fashion items, like big cravats and tight breeches. And for women, they would wear extensive sheer white and pastel muslin.
But on that marvelous and incredible revelation about historical French fashion, Jess, are we all more or less all wrapped up like in a cardigan?
We have many yards left to cover. We went kind of all over the place in terms of timing and in terms of
clothing everywhere.
Which, I mean, I feel like that's delightfully chaotic. So hopefully we can return to this topic in a different way and with different terms. Maybe we can address cottagecore and normcore and cyberpunk next time we want to talk about aesthetics.
Sounds wonderful. I'll be there for it. We hope you'll be there for it too. We'll catch you in the very next Words Unraveled.
See you next time.